Okay.
It's time for rate regulation. Which all of a sudden seems very simple compared to what we went through.
The end of the survey.
It is.
Okay, Jane.
Okay, thank you.
You're in the mood.
I was going to say, after that session, I think this will be a light-hearted session. We're talking about rate-regulated activities. I'd like to welcome Mariella to the table, who's recently joined the project team for rate-regulated activities and has helped out with some of the papers this month. The papers that we're presenting this afternoon are agenda papers 9A and 9B. 9A summarises what we've discussed so far over the last couple, two or three board meetings, together with a summary of feedback from our previous consultations that we've used to develop the description of defined rate regulation and how it works in practice that's underpinning the model that we're trying to develop. I don't intend to go through Agenda Paper 9A in this session for comments, but obviously if anybody's got any questions or any issues they'd like to raise in that paper, I'm happy to take those as we go along and address them if needed. Particularly, by the way, if anybody has identified any gaps in the Appendix B, which is our summary of the topics that we still need to discuss going forward. The focus of today's discussion, though, is Agenda Paper 9B, which contains five examples that we've drawn from the common types of rate adjustments that we see in practice that we're trying to use to develop the principles of the model with. And we've used a water utility company or entity as the basis for this example. And that entity, Entity W, operates under a regulatory agreement that has the characteristics of defined rate regulation that we've talked about previously. As it says in paragraphs 13 to 16 of Agenda Paper 9B, we have used quite a few simplifying assumptions in drawing up these examples. In particular, we say that the rate regulation allows Entity W to recover its allowable costs but not to earn any profit or return, because we think that having a profit bottom line of zero is easy for people to follow the numbers. Also, all of the costs that are incurred during the three-year period that we're looking at in the examples are all accounted for in the same way for regulatory purposes as they are for IFRS purposes, unless we've specifically mentioned differences in the examples. So everything else is the same. We also assume that the time value of money is immaterial, and also that the regulation and the rate adjustment mechanism is sufficiently clear that there is no uncertainty about what amounts are included in the rate adjustment mechanism, or any uncertainty that the level of demand will continue at its forecast rate, so that we will be able to reverse out any of the adjustments that we're recognising. Now, in future meetings, we do intend to relax these simplifications so that we can test the robustness of the model and start to develop measurement requirements and other requirements. But for the purpose of this meeting, we'd like to really focus on the simplified examples so we can make clear the basic principles and the mechanics of the model. This is particularly so because for each of the five examples we're going to go through, we'd like you to answer the question that's in paragraph 68 of the paper, which is, do you agree with our conclusions about the timing and amount of recognition of the originating differences and also the reversal, the pattern and timing of the reversal of those adjustments that we're recognising? Before we get started on example one, I'd like to give a quick reminder that the board has previously agreed that in developing the model, we are focusing on the rights and obligations that arise through the rate adjustment mechanism in the rate regulation. We're not trying to account for all of the rights and obligations incorporated within the regulatory agreement, and so we're not looking to build an intangible asset model. Instead, we are just focusing on the rights to increase the future rate that comes through the rate adjustment mechanism, or the obligation to decrease the future rate, again coming out of that rate adjustment mechanism. We're not trying to capture the overall right to increase or the overall obligation to decrease the rate that relates to future transactions and price changes. So we're trying to bed the model in the past transactions that are reflected through that rate adjustment mechanism. Again, that's summed up in paragraph 14b of agenda paper 9a, just as a reminder that that's the focus of the model. In going through the five examples in paper 9b, I'm assuming that people are comfortable with where the numbers come from and how the numbers fit together, so I'm not going to spend time going through those, but again, if anybody's got any questions they'd like clarifying, then we can pick those up as we go along. But what I would like to do is just introduce each example one by one so that we can focus on the rights and obligations that we're looking to account for in the model, so that at the end of each individual example we can ask the question in paragraph 68 to see whether you agree with our conclusions for each example individually. With that then, before we start on example one, does anybody have any issues or questions or comments they'd like to make before we get into the examples?
Thank you. Before we go into each example, I would like to ask a question on paper 9A, especially the table you provided. I really appreciate this table. And let me ask an unproductive question. On the left-hand side, there is an incoming new conceptual framework, ED. But what if we put the current conceptual framework on the left-hand side? Would it change the right-hand side description? That is an unproductive question. The reason why I'm asking this unproductive and not forward-looking question is because this is going to be the first interpretation of our new conceptual framework. And that this relates to this kind of difficult issue, which could be intangible asset. Of course, it's not the intangible asset, but you know, if the conceptual framework is different, it could be interpreted as intangible asset. So it may provide variety of other interpretation of conceptual framework. So therefore, we have to be very careful about why we land this kind of description because of new conceptual framework, which was not possible in the current conceptual framework, or which was still possible, but it was not clear. Therefore, we appreciate new conceptual framework, but it doesn't really change the right-hand side. So that is the point I was very curious.
I don't think we should ask that question. I think it's...
Because it's got real consequences.
Yeah, it's got consequences. It's a pointless exercise. Yeah. I don't think we should answer it.
What could possible consequence? I think it's pointless, but
the effects people have concluded today about what they can and can't do.
Yeah.
So it's a real question for the market. So it's dangerous to answer it, especially on the fly. Yeah. Bad tax.
Okay, tax.
Okay.
Thank you for your contribution. Let's go to the examples.
Thank you, Anne. So we'll
can I ask you one quick, and this is on the example. I just wanted to clarify for my own. I mean, the examples work out really neatly because every time you see an effect, you see it come out at zero, so you're really happy. But just to re-emphasize something you said, the focus of the model is entirely on example 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. The bottom line outcome is purely coincidental. So no matter what the profitability of this entity would be, we're not targeting that line at all. We're targeting each of the transactions.
Absolutely. It's the rights and obligations triggered by each of the transactions.
And each of them are then assessed independently of what the outcome might be.
Yeah.
I think it's just... Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, so example one, which is covered in paragraphs 23 to 30, this is the only example out of the five where we've got an estimation variance, so the amounts involved are different from those that we originally anticipated. The variance arises in year one when the entity incurs a higher allowable input cost than originally estimated. The regulatory agreement is clear that this variance of 2,000 is included in the rate adjustment mechanism, and therefore in year two the entity will charge a higher rate in order to charge customers that additional 2,000 in year two. So in this case we conclude that the entity does have an asset at the end of year one, and that reflects the right to charge that additional 2,000 because of the activity that's already been carried out in year one. So it's the past transactions in year one, and that right to charge that higher rate in year two is consumed within year two when we charge that higher rate, and so there's nothing left to recognise at the end of year two because the asset has reversed through, been consumed in that year. There are no other variances in the example, and so in year three there is nothing different to recognise between the regulatory numbers and the IFRS numbers. Perhaps just worth noting that for convenience in each of these examples we have shown the regulated rate adjustment as a separate line item in the profit or loss account between the revenue line and the allowable costs line that would be recognised under existing IFRS standards. That's not to make a statement about where we think we should end up in this project, but just for convenience so you can follow the numbers, seeing the IFRS, existing IFRS numbers, and the separate line item. We've also done netting in when we get to the bottom line, asset or liability, when we've added all the five examples together. Again, there's no intention to preempt any decisions on presentation or netting. It's just for the convenience of simplifying the numbers and the presentation for the purpose of this meeting. You may have noticed in paragraph 68, we've got a secondary question. If anybody wants to express any initial views as we're going through on presentation, we'd be quite happy to hear them. But we will come back with a separate discussion on presentation at a later date. With that then, I'll just open the floor if anybody's got any comments or questions on example one before we take a vote.
Questions? All clear?
Okay,
the adjustment has been granted.
Okay. I was going to say, do we need to ask, does everybody agree with our conclusions in example?
No, we don't agree.
No.
But I would not say so. Then my intentions keep silent.
don't encourage him to speak, please. Example two,
well,
then moving
look, sorry,
on quickly.
I do have one question or one comment I wanted to make about paragraph 26. I followed the example. I agree with the workings, but then when I went back and tested the logic of 26, and I think I just want to make this comment, I don't want to try and resolve it, you know, now, and is... I'm not sure I agree with the analysis of control in this situation, because I think the entity does control the right to charge in future, but I'm not sure that I agree with the analysis as it's set out in this paragraph. I don't think we get from the fact that all you have to do is control the benefits that would result to saying, therefore, you control that right to charge. I think we just have to think more clearly about how we articulate the logic of the analysis in paragraph 26. I struggled with saying that I saw that fitting right up against the definition of an asset And I just wanted to leave that as an observation to kind of think about offline.
Okay. I'm not quite clear what additional step, whether you need us to talk about whether it's got a potential to...
Well, it's having said in the first sentence, you do not control whether the customers will buy water services in the future. It then sounds like we're saying, so we're not sure that we control this item. I think that the answer is going to be going back to some of the characteristics of defined rate regulation that explains why in this limited set of circumstances we control an asset as a result of a right to increase prices in future. I think the second and third sentences that you have here do not overcome the problem that you identify in the first sentence. Entity W cannot control whether its customers will buy. That seems to raise a question about meeting the definition of control.
That certainly wasn't the intention of that, because okay. I think when we're looking at inventory or PP&E or any other type of asset, we don't control whether we're going to sell to customers in order to recover that, but we'll still recognize
that's the realization, not the control of the item. And since the item that's controlled here is the right to charge higher prices in future, that, you know, we haven't, to me, explained how we control that right. I think it's more complicated than what's in this paragraph, and I think it goes back to the characteristics of defined rate regulation itself, the particular combination of characteristics.
Yeah.
And so that's what I think we have to think about. To me, this just kind of picks up, you know, it picks up another concept that's in the definition of the element of an asset, which is you have to, you don't have to be certain that you'll get benefits, you just have to control the benefits that arise. I agree, that's why it doesn't have to be a certainty that you will have, you know, that you will receive a benefit, but that doesn't explain to me why you control the, you know, the why you control an asset as a result of having a right to increase prices in the future. I think we have an answer in the characteristics of defined rate regulation, and since that's not kind of the focal point of today's discussion, I don't want to belabor the point, but I didn't want to kind of leave this set in stone as our analysis of satisfying the control leg of the asset definition. And I, as I said, I think satisfying the control leg goes back to the combination of circumstances created by the characteristics of defined rate regulation.
Okay, let's move on to...
Sorry, I was going to say, I'd like to just respond partly to that, but I'm conscious whether Francoise was making the same point or whether I should respond first.
If I'm allowed to, yes, I would like. I think the it's the contract with the regulator that provides the control of that right. And I take this opportunity to say that I still think that the labels are right to increase a future right, obligation to decrease a future right, are not sufficiently descriptive. And I think they are making people uncomfortable with what we're talking about. And I would, in fact, recommend that we look into building, I mean, it's a possibility, I'm not sure that's the solution, but at least it's a possibility that we look into describing these assets and liabilities as the rights and obligations based on, you know, having as a starting point the contract asset and the contract liability definition that we have in IFRS 15. They would not be the exact same things because it's. But I think we would describe clearly that it is something that, in case of a right that the entity has acquired, and that doesn't show out of the current description of increased right to increase a future right. It would also make the distinction because as soon as the regulator has approved a future right, basically you have that right, but you would not recognize it. So it's also not descriptive of exactly what you are looking at. And I think it would help people understand better if we were having better descriptions.
I agree with Francois' sentiment here. The short answer is the increase in the rate doesn't capture what we're trying to capture, which is part of the confusion, because obviously at the beginning of year one in this example, we have the right to charge at least the 30, which is our estimate, as well as any variance that comes through. But we're not going to recognise that because we're trying to link to the definition in the framework about the right coming from a past event. And in this case, the past event is not the agreement of the rate. It's the transaction that triggers that variance adjustment. So it's only that rate adjustment true-up that we're trying to capture here. And to go back to Mary's point, I think we've moved away from focusing on the characteristics of defined rate regulation in terms of defining recognition or getting to the assets and liability definitions, because there's a legally binding contractual right here, the regulatory agreement, which sets up the rights and obligations. And if we're looking at a right, it's our right to recover these amounts, albeit conditional, we have to keep delivering services in the future. And that right has got the potential to generate the inflow of economic benefits. The characteristics, and we'll come back to this as we're simplifying some of these examples in a future meeting, I think the characteristics help support the recoverability and increase the probability that that right will result in the inflow. But I think the regulatory agreement, the legally binding agreement, creates the right. We said in the simplifications here, there's no uncertainty that we're going to continue providing the services. There's no uncertainty about the fact that we will be charging customers in the future, which supports the recognition. But I think it's helpful to distinguish between the existence of the right and what that right is compared to should it be recognised because it's...
I am not persuaded by the argument that it is just the existence of the regulatory agreement without the specific features of defined rate regulation. I'm not persuaded that it's the existence of a regulatory contract that creates rights and obligations that meet the definition of asset and liability. I'm not, you know, I'm supportive of us pursuing this model in the development. I'm not trying to derail that, but I think we have to think very carefully about why a right that an unregulated entity has, which is to, you know, to change prices and maybe be subject to some performance obligations, is different in this case. And I think it is not as straightforward as the existence of a regulatory agreement. So I think we have to go back and spell out some things that I think are being shorthanded in that expression, rather than it being a fundamentally different thing.
Okay.
All right.
Okay. Thank you. Example two. In example two here, again, the amounts involved are as per the estimates. In this case, though, the entity at the end of year one has received a benefit of charging a higher rate, but during year one it hasn't satisfied any of the obligations relating to its right to charge that higher rate. So we conclude that at the end of year one, the entity has a liability which reflects the past benefit of getting the extra $50,000 in year one, and the fact that it's got the obligation then in future, once it's satisfied its requirement to carry out this enhanced maintenance work, it won't be able to charge a rate that's high enough to recover the cost of that maintenance work because it's already received some benefit in advance. At the end of year two then, we've got a different situation because during year two, the entity has fully satisfied its requirement to carry out the maintenance work. In this case though, at the end of year two, it's only charged customers a total of 100, 50 in year one and 50 in year two. It has a remaining right to charge an extra 50 in year three because it has already carried out the activities necessary for that additional amount being charged. So at the end of year one, there's a regulatory liability of 50. At the end of year two, there's a regulatory asset of 50, which is then consumed during year three when we charge the extra amount, the higher rate during X3. So again, any comments or questions in example two before we ask whether you agree with our conclusion.
No. Do we agree?
Yep.
Wait, Wei Guo, am I just assuming?
Wei Guo doesn't.
I will say by the end.
We come with a surprise decision.
Okay, if Wei Guo decides to agree, I'm sure he'll make sure you know.
Yes. Okay. Example three, then, which relates to accelerated depreciation. In this example, the entity has incurred some costs which the regulatory agreement makes clear they can recover by charging customers in the future as they're providing services. In this case, we're going to be providing services using this new software asset over a three-year period. We will depreciate over the 3 years as we consume the asset. But the regulator has decided we can charge higher rates in years one and two so that we accelerate the amount that we're charging to customers. But the opposite side to that is in year three, we carry on delivering the services at the same level, except we are obliged to charge a lower rate in year three to reflect the fact we've already charged the higher rate in years one and two. So again, at the end of years one and two, we conclude that there is going to be a liability because the company has already received benefits of the higher rate during years one and two. That obligation then is satisfied in year three when we carry on providing the services, but at the lower rate. So everything goes back to zero by the end of the three-year period. So again, any comments or questions about example three?
Tom.
I just have one comment. I don't like the title accelerated depreciation. I think it's a bit misleading. The depreciation is what the depreciation is. You're talking about building regulatory assets and liabilities. The regulatory asset and liability says you can factor this into your rate, your rates you're going to charge in the following order. You're still depreciating exactly the same rate. And I think goes a little bit just to, I think we need to be very careful in our wording as we go through this and keep the focus on what we're considering, which is creating regulatory assets and regulatory liabilities that should create better periodic performance measurement.
Thanks. Yeah, that's a fair comment. It's the charging of customers that's accelerated, you're right, not the depreciation.
Mary?
When I was looking at paragraph 42 in this, again, this is something where it's not just that I like the outcome. I agree with the analysis, especially when I step back and think about the very helpful characterization in this paper, say, I can't remember which, about thinking of it as, I'm going to screw it up, temporary differences. And you know, when you step back and you think of it that way, It really comes together, especially thinking about just the slice that is the difference in what you charge. But when I look at the analysis in paragraph 42, and it says, as a result, the entity is obliged to transfer goods or services on terms that are unfavorable to the entity. Again, I think we might just have to be careful in tuning the wording of the analysis, because reverting to, quote, the normal price, having front-ended recovery of the extra cost, you know, returning to a normal price doesn't strike me as being an unfavorable price. You know, we're reverting to it without the layer added on. And I think, again, that we just have to think about how we express this so we don't confuse people in terms of thinking, oh, I might have a situation that's analogous, I'm going to apply the same thinking. And I think it's right when we're thinking about temporary differences in the framework of a regulatory agreement that has certain characteristic that sets it apart, and we're then accounting for all the temporary differences that come up for the differences between the regulatory timing and the billings to customer, which is the recovery.
Martin,
now, when I read this example, I was reminded on our discussion which we had on depreciations based on revenue. And we said, okay, you are not allowed, okay, if your revenue pattern is in one regard, but your consumption pattern of your, as it is different, that you could align that. But exactly that is what we are doing here. And I thought, regarding the outcome, is it really, we doing all that because I think my understanding was we want to compare the situation with a company which has not the right regulations. But this is not the case here, because also the company which has not any right regulation could not align their revenue patterns and there is a depreciation pattern, because we don't allow that, and was, I think, what we decided 2 years ago. Also, on the example number two, is the same issue, because they have a company has maintenance costs in the second year, and we think, okay, the rate regulator said you can't increase immediately, that is the reason why we then allowing adjusting that or allocating that over 3 years. But in the in other industries, the same. If you have a highly competitive industry, also you cannot immediately change your price to get then, I think, recovery for your maybe additional costs, because you have to maybe do it slowly, because otherwise you are out of market. But what we are doing here is really we doing a kind of matching principle between revenues and costs, and which we are not allowing in all other kind of industries. And so just looking at, I have not said it is the wrong model, but I think just looking from the P&L outcome, it feels for me wrong. Because only because you are rate regulated, you are we allowing this kind of matching principle. And example two is very clear, because mine says, is you cannot immediately change your price if you are rate regulated, but it is also true if the market determines that you cannot change your price. But even only it isn't regulated, then you are can do it. If it is other forces, which then you can't do it. And is it a sufficiently difference to allowing this kind of companies to doing this, I would say, matching principle. After reading all the examples from me, it is matching principle. We're matching revenues with...
I think just, I'm not going to go into all of those points. In terms of the depreciation and the revenue-based depreciation, I know we said that presentation was a secondary issue here, but I think in that particular case it is important, because the depreciation is trying to show the consumption of the asset, whereas what and we're keeping the consumption pattern as it is, and what we're doing by splitting out the presentation is saying actually it is a the regulator is involved in setting the rate that's charged to customers. The regulator is not dictating, as Tom said, the rate of depreciation or consumption of the asset.
I don't think that we are applying the matching principle here. I think we're reflecting the price at which the deliveries that have been made will be paid ultimately, part by the client, that the customer that has already received the services, and by the rest of the population on top of it. And the fact that it matches is no more than the, reflecting the fact that the agreement is a cost plus agreement in essence. So what it reflects, in fact, is that in each period you earn what you're entitled to earn, and it happens to match, but it's because you are in fact in a cost-plus environment.
I think that goes back to Daryl's point at the beginning, the clarification that the fact that it goes back to zero, it is because the regulator is setting it at zero. It's kind of coincidental. In that respect, yeah.
Chungwu.
Thank you. On Mary's comment that paragraph 42, unfavorable, you are suggesting another expression, right? Rather than unfavorable terms. Because you have received the amount in year one. So that's why you are. You have an obligation to transfer water service in terms of unfavorable to the entity. That is what is described here. But But you, if we are saying because we received some amount in year one, then this is a kind of a year two. You have a kind of a, even though you are receiving a right on a proper amount of this water service, so you are saying this is not unfavorable. Just you know, just the right terms in year one, year two, right?
That's I was raising a question about calling it delivery on unfavorable terms.
Yes.
When it is the normal price, right. Just without the extra amount. And I think what's maybe more at the heart of paragraph, well, of the reason for recognizing an obligation in years one and two is the fact that you have been paid in it, essentially in advance before using that software to deliver in the third year. It's something more related to you've got to pre-bill, and so the same way that if we were in a different kind of industry, the fact that I might have had the right to bill you in advance, the fact that I got to bill doesn't mean that I am entitled
I understand your point. I agree with you in some sense. However, in the case of advance receipt or a kind of a deferred receipt, in that case, the customer is the same.
Right.
But in this case, the customer base is in year one, and the customer base is year two, maybe different.
Yeah.
So it might not be easy to say this is a kind of a advance payment or deferred payment.
Which is why it's not.
That's why I said this kind of a expression.
Yeah.
And in the unfavorable terms, might get over that kind of a different transaction.
If it was with the same customer, then I think it would be an adjustment of revenue.
Yes.
Because we'd be thinking about it in the, you were made to, let's say for this water services company, you were made to put £1,000 deposit up front. And so then it would be owed to you as the customer, and it would be an adjustment of revenue. Here, it's not owed to you as the customer, but because I'm also accounting for some of the rights and obligations under the regulatory agreement, I have to reflect in my accounting that I have not performed the activities that earn, under the agreement that earned me that. So I just think it's the phrase, but it's we're not allowed. Remember, Hans is the one who banned us from talking about customer base.
Yes. Okay. I guess this point is a kind of a special feature of this regulatory agreement and regulatory transaction.
Yes.
So Marty is saying, why not? Why they are different? This is one difference between this normal market transaction and regular. Customer base is different. So we can't use normal expressions on these things. So that's why I guess Jane invented very creative expressions to show this kind of differences between
but,
these
but
two.
You're right. It's an objection to the expression, not to the concept.
All right. Stephen?
I don't have a problem with the expression because I think in year three, it is unfavorable terms. The regulation is that you recover costs. And you could just say that and you could have a true up at the end of the year, but they've modified it. And in year three, you are being allowed to recover something less than your cost because of this variance and as a result of what's gone on in years one and two. So I think literally in year three, you are dealing on unfavorable terms relative to the base case, which is you charge revenue equals the cost.
Or, you're not recovering your cost, and the cost is your $4,000 of depreciation in the period. But that's because, you've already recovered it.
But is that dangerous to use that as the explanation, focusing on recovering cost? Because this is an easy example because it's all 0000.
Yeah.
But if you were allowed to have a particular...
No, I was saying it in relative to the... To my mind, there's two bits of regulation going on here. Part one regulation is you're allowed to charge revenue equal to costs. part two of the regulation is things are happening, so we'll modify that on a case-by-case basis to deal with the variance accelerated depreciation. And it's this sort of second layer of the regulation that creates the assets and liabilities.
All right.
So it's an adjustment from the first thing, which might be cost plus a profit.
Yeah, and that first layer could be cost plus, could, all sorts of things could be present in that first layer.
In future meetings, we'll come back with some examples where it's a cost plus and see the effect.
I thought that's what Steve meant, but I just, for people listening, I just.
Okay.
Example four. In this situation, we have got the construction of an asset, and included in the overall cost of that asset is £20,000 of overhead costs that, for the purposes of IAS 16, would not be included in the cost of the asset for IFRS purposes, but it is a cost that's been incurred. In this case, the regulatory agreement says that instead of treating that as an allowable cost in year one when it's actually incurred, the entity will be able to recover that allowable cost in the future, straight line over 10 years, because it's going to be included in the rate on that basis over the next 10 years once we start using the asset going forward. So in this case, we do have a temporary difference between what we would book for IFRS purposes and what is being reflected in the regulated rate. And so we conclude in this case that at the end of year one, the entity would recognise a regulatory asset of the 20,000, which are the overheads that have already been incurred. They are allowable costs. The entity has a right to charge customers in order to recognise or recover those costs, but that right will flow through in the regulated rate in the future. And therefore, once we start charging that higher rate, that right then is consumed over that period as we start charging the higher rate and recovering those allowable costs as we go along each year for 10 years. So again, same question. Any comments or questions before we ask whether you agree with our conclusion?
My point again, in this example, man, this 20,000, the company which is not rate regulated, they incur this 20,000 cost, book it in the P&L, and maybe they also recovering that 20,000 in prices which they charge the next 10 years. So why is that different? Why are we allowing these companies now to not have this 20 in the cost to defer it over 10 years? Other companies, we don't doing that. So that is what I'm again struggling with this example.
Because in this case, it is close to being guaranteed.
I mean, it's not the point of the example. I think it's the point of the scope. So the question is, we would say that we would treat transactions differently where there is this tripartite agreement. If we assume that we're comfortable with that different treatment, then I think this example exactly correctly reflects the outcome that we would expect. But I presume that at a later point when we come to discuss scope, that would be a discussion we'd have then, is are we comfortable with these transactions being scoped into this type of arrangement? And to Martin's point, I think we would need to then say that are we comfortable that there is sufficient difference in the economics created by the regulatory override to put us in the sort of, to account for it in a different way?
Again, I'm happy for the board members and then I'll come back.
Makes sense. I think I'm aligned with Dario's comment. I think Martin has a fair point for us as a board to really be very clear in why we decided to take the route of this project. So I think that is the challenge that he posed before us in terms of the scope of the project and why. We just would like to take note first to be very clear when drafting, I would say, a DP or a D, whatever, and to be comfortable enough, as Dario mentioned, about the scope of the project.
One question, even if a company would have guaranteed future sales, we would not allow that.
I think one of the things I would say, and it goes back to what Mary was saying in her exchange with Chung Wu about the difference between a single customer and the customers through the regulatory agreement. Because if this was an arrangement with a single customer where the company had to, you know, construct an asset in order to complete a contract with a customer, then, you know, we wouldn't book this 20,000 under IAS 16 as an asset, but we would be booking it as a contract asset under IFRS 15 and following the treatment that we've got in example 4. If there was that one-to-one relationship where the customer has said, you've incurred these costs, you can charge me those costs and I will pay them in the future. So it's not trying to compare with the market, it's just trying to reflect the agreement.
And I think I was going to comment on Martin's statement about the guaranteed future. So, and I think that's the same thing. So if I've got guaranteed future sales in that the sales are part of a contract with a single customer and the price is variable based on coal price, let's say, or whatever the other driver might be, but the cash flows kind of are worked on a cumulative catch-up, I think we would exactly reflect that adjustment in the current period to reflect the value of the thing we've delivered at the best estimate price of that thing we've delivered. So I think that's possibly the better analogy, is if this was this two-part contract but with an individual customer, what would be the outcome? Now we're replacing the idea of the individual customer with the idea of the regulator intervening and saying, does that create the same triangle?
And again, to Mary's previous point, but if it was with a single customer, this would be a revenue adjustment, but because it's with the regulatory agreement, it's a separate line.
Martin is convinced. Mary?
No, I'm not convinced.
You say in Dutch, who is silent agrees.
I have a dumb mechanics question. I was looking at this and trying to map it through, and we see an adjustment of 2 going through. Is that the net of the difference?
Sorry, yes, it is. So it is the difference. We would be charging or including in the amount bills to customers the 17, which is 170 yes. over the 10, and we would be charging depreciation of 15, the 150 yeah. over 10 under 6.
For IFRS, 16. Yeah.
So apologies, yeah, yes. I'm quite conscious now you've raised that. I use the net in example yeah. 4 and I switch to the gross presentation in example 5. But I guess it gives people an opportunity to select.
And you know, I know we're not predetermining presentation of these things, but just to make sure that we're following the mechanics,
the
I just wanted to check
mechanics.
That was...
Yeah, that's absolutely right.
As I said, it was a dumb mechanics question.
Not a dumb question at all. No,
okay, more dumb questions, François? Yes.
I think it's likely to be a dumb question, but I raise it nevertheless. Have you thought of the possibility of capitalizing those costs?
Sorry, capitalizing which cost?
The costs of
20,000.
The 20,000. I think it in terms of what you would show, it would not necessarily make a difference.
Yeah, I think that's down to, instead of saying that we're capitalising the cost, we're recognising a regulatory asset of 20. The bottom line effect is exactly the same. It's just what we're trying to do is reflect the nature of the right, which is we can charge the customers that 20,000 going forward. So the asset itself is that right to charge the customers rather than being a PP&E asset in nature. But the bottom line, it makes no difference at all.
Personally, I prefer what you have proposed because it keeps everything outside of the regulatory agreement presented and reported exactly in the same way as for other companies. But following Martin's questions, I was wondering whether some would better accept the outcome if it was presented that way.
I think that the reason we've been pushed into it this way is because IS 16 for the type of overheads is explicit. You don't include it in the cost.
It also seems to better reflect the economics of what the regulator is imposing on you.
Personally, I agree with that.
And I think it's really important that we focus on what it is, which is the right to charge, because in this very simplified example, it's strictly cost recovery. But in a case which is perhaps more normal, in which you incurred a cost of 20, but had the right to recover, let's say, I'm going to make the math easier, 30, capitalizing 20 wouldn't tell you about the right you had to bill 30, and what you, you know, what we are recognizing is the adjustment, you know, the future billing adjustment, which in my cost plus example is the 30 number, not the 20. And because we are accounting for the effects of the rate regulation, I think it's very important that we express it the way you have expressed it here, as recognizing the change in the future right to bill.
Just to elaborate a tiny bit on what Mary said and why they're distinct assets or liabilities, if we go this route, is the dollar amount might be different than what we're looking at. They might choose a somewhat different amount. And not only that, but when you get to do it, and what, like, you, they might let you do 10% in year one and 90% in year two, or it might be, and what the regulatory asset liability will do is it will track when you get to do the disproportionately high or low rates. It's not the use of the asset. The asset could last 50 years. And if they say you get it all in year one, that's when the asset gets thrown in and it disappears. And I think, I'm not sure if that's what Darrell was saying when he said recognizing the economics, but the economics of the right to charge something different is different than the usage of some underlying asset that was linked to the creation of the regulatory asset or liability.
Yes, Amari?
A general comment that's related directly to this point. I think we should be very clear about, not, we are trying to be very clear about the scope of the project, and I think we should at this stage also drive the staff not to really think about other aspects that might impact existing literature, like this one that would imply actually revising IS 16 in terms of what should be added to PP&E. So I think this, as I would propose, as a general direction, really to avoid any change in literature and try to keep only into this project.
I'm good.
Okay, shall we go to the last example?
Okay. So example five, again, this relates to the construction of items of property, plant and equipment. In this example, Entity W charges a higher rate in year one, and that higher rate is linked to an agreement by the rate regulator that the entity will build or upgrade part of the infrastructure network during year two, and then use that upgraded infrastructure network in year three onwards over the 10-year useful economic life. At the end of year one, we conclude that again the entity has an obligation of 30. That obligation represents or reflects the fact that the company has already received the benefit of 30 during year one, but it has an obligation to charge that lower rate in the future for the services it's going to be delivering in the future. And the reason it's charging that lower rate is because it's already had this benefit of 30. So in year one, there's a liability at the end of year one. Nothing changes in year two, because in year two we actually carry out the construction. Nothing goes through profit or loss account, because the amounts recognised for regulatory purposes is the same as for IFRS purposes in terms of the 90,000 allowable cost of construction. The difference here then, this temporary difference, is from an IFRS point of view, will recognise a cost of 90,000, which is going to be depreciated straight line over 10 years starting in year three. That's the consumption of the asset, but we're only going to be allowed to bill 6,000 per annum for 10 years starting in year three, because we've already billed 30,000 in year one.
So again, at the end of year three, we're reducing down that regulatory liability because we've had a year's worth of providing services at that lower rate of six. Again, any comments, questions?
No? Okay. Then I'll final...
That's it?
Yeah, hold on. I was going to say, I'm going to give a final opportunity to Weibo, to the end of his board membership, to show to pledge his support for this for this project. Please go ahead.
I want to offer four comments. Firstly, actually I will emphasize tomorrow in my evening presentation, the ones are hated are the ones are loved. Means I spend more time, just like leasing and the project. So Jen, don't worry, you know, I hate you. I love you.
Luckily, I'm very special. I'm very thick-skinned and don't take it personally.
Secondly, frankly speaking, I feel it is pity. We quite often say we have the model, we are generating model. And we are accountants, you know, we are setting standards. In my view, something we call the models must have something like recognition principles, measurement, and scope, and others. And I don't think up to now, after 4 or 5 years, we have the models, which I will view that the model. And certainly, this paper gave me impression which I feel it is wrong. That is, as long as you meet definition, whether I agree with or not, you know, it's another issue. And you will be allowed or you will be required to recognize. I think it is totally wrong, particularly under the current the new conceptual framework. Under the old conceptual framework, we have recognition threshold and definition. Within the definition, we already have the probability, the probable cash flow in it. And therefore, to meet or not meet definition, to some extent, will exclude something which will be in the recognition side. But new conceptual framework separate the principles into different parts, and we feel logically it is right. And therefore, in the future, including this project, we should not say so. That is, meet definition, therefore you can recognize. We have to discuss recognition, whether you meet the criteria, and within the recognition criteria, you have to take into consideration measurement side. Of course, the paper said we will discuss later, but how can you, in this paper, this is why when you want to ask me whether you agree with the discussions or not, I may say yes. Or whether you agree with the conclusion, I may say not. It's because in my view, you cannot conclude simply because you meet definition. As I want to emphasize, under new conceptual framework, this is more important than under old conceptual framework. Otherwise, we will give people impression in the new conceptual framework, we can easily go over the hurdle to recognize more as a liability. This is my second point. The third point, my last point is to discuss the special accounting from simplistic transactions. Maybe it's good, but I don't think in reality, I will not say, you know, there is no such kind of simplistic examples. But in reality, I don't think it will be realistic. Therefore, you know, from beginning, I'm against is because in reality, it will not be easier to identify direct relationship between such a regulatory clause, such a regulatory decision with a particular cash flow. I don't think it is possible most of the time. And this is why, you know, I agree with Martin, and I hope Martin can take my job in the future. And lastly, is that bad back to the original DP discussion. That is, you know, with such a simplistic discussions, we cannot solve the issue of the scope. Because even we conclude everything we agreed, like today, looks like everybody agreed. But when we discuss the scope, the reality will not be so easy. Then, by the end, we may fail. This is why, what I want to offer, Hans, whether you agree or not.
Okay, thank you, Igor. I think we've come to the conclusion of today's meeting, vastly over time, but that doesn't matter.
Three minutes.
I thought it was being very liberal. Okay.